I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. Listen to any American political speech, Republican or Democrat, and you're bound to hear some of the same language. The United States is one of the greatest democracies in history, a beacon of freedom, a selfless force of good in the world. The virtues that define what make America special and unique are all part of the narrative of American exceptionalism. This is a powerful and enduring story that shapes how Americans see themselves, their relationship to others, and their place in the world. But the stories we tell about ourselves can sometimes be threatened. Sudden, unexpected catastrophes can shake us to our core. They can undermine our confidence and certainty. They can fill us with fear and self-doubt. In these instances, we can either double down on the old, time-worn, comforting stories, or we can try to come to grips with reality, however unsettling. In this episode, we'll consider how the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001 challenged the story of American exceptionalism. We'll look at how, in the years that followed, Americans tried to memorialize and make sense of this past by doubling down on the old story, often with disastrous and far-reaching consequences. We'll consider how, after 20 years of the war on terror, we may finally be moving into a new post-9/11 era of more critical memory. American memory in the post-9/11 era in this episode of Realms of Memory. At New York University, Marita Sterkin is a professor in the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication. She's a scholar of memory studies, visual culture, and American studies. She spent the past 30 years looking at how the politics of memory shapes questions about national identity in the United States. I'll be talking with her today about her more recent book, Terrorism in American Memory: Memorials, Museums, and Architecture in the Post-9/11 Era. Marita, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thank you.
So I wanted to begin with a question of just the overarching theme of your book. I mean, you bracket off the first 20 years of the 21st century as this particular moment in American history that you can understand through memory. And my sense is that if you're looking at these first 20 years and thinking about them in terms of memory, does memory serve us is the question that you could ask. And what I took away from your book is that it really doesn't. For most of those 20 years, that if you look at how memory works and you frame memory in terms of 9/11 exceptionalism, which you say is an extension of American exceptionalism, and you point out all the ways in which it works against us, whether you're looking at memorials or museums or towers that are put up or shopping malls, or that it works against our interests in a variety of ways. So I was hoping you could start by just explaining, well, what do you mean by American exceptionalism? How is 9/11 exceptionalism an extension of this?
Yeah, I think The book itself is really focused on what I call the post-9/11 era. And part of my argument about that is that by the time we get to 2020, the post-9/11 era is over. And we're just beginning to understand that. And now, even just a few years later, I think that's become clearer, right? That 9/11 is not a reference point for us today, in a way that it was for almost two decades. And so, within that, we have to think about why this event was overshadowed American culture so seriously and dramatically that it shaped foreign policy. It shaped a lot of domestic politics and disputes, and it shaped a lot of how we thought about ourselves as Americans during that period. And so, in a certain sense, one of the narratives that helps shape that is the idea that it was an event unlike any other, that there was September 10th, and then on September 12th, the world had changed. Now, of course, exceptionalist narratives have shaped other historical events, the most classic one, of course, being the Holocaust, and this sort of sense that this is an unparalleled event in human history, And it can't be compared to other kinds of events because it was so horrific, because its impact was so profound, right? And I would say we probably always want to be suspicious of exceptionalist narratives, right? Because more often than not, they're revealing a different set of desires and agendas and politics and in the broad scope of human history, there are no truly exceptional events. So that story about 9/11 has a lot of effect in terms of the years that followed. And it's a largely unquestioned story, the idea that 9/11 was exceptional. In the book, I talk about the proliferation of memorials about 9/11, which is quite extraordinary, more than 1,200 of them, something we haven't seen since the memorialization around the Civil War. Why is that? Why is that happening? Why are memorials being built in Florida and in California? And the other part of that that I want to argue is that that fits into a broader historical narrative of American exceptionalism, which many historians have written about, the sense in America that we think of ourselves as an ideal nation, as a nation to be emulated, as an exceptional nation. And that has fed into our relationship to global politics, our relationship to the rest of the world, right? That is, of course, a narrative that is questioned all the time, right? The exceptionalism of America that came out of World War II is then questioned by the Vietnam War. It's questioned by other conflicts, right? But it remains a very powerful narrative to the American public, and I think you can hear it reiterated constantly in political discourse today, even in the speeches that are being made and by the Democratic Party, right? And that narrative also is disabling in many ways because it allows us not to see many things, including the impact of our foreign policy on our relations with the rest of the world.
So my sense is that this is kind of like the fairy tale narrative, right? If you tune into the Republican or the Democratic conventions, you heard how the U.S. is the greatest country in the history of the world, the heir to the greatest democracies, and on and on. That's kind of that American exceptionalist idea, right? So that if you see yourself as a gift to humanity, and then you have 9/11 happen, it's like, how do you filter that experience through that narrative, through that lens, that particular lens? And that seems to be the crux of the matter, is that you can only understand it in limited ways. That if this is happening to you, well, this is coming out of the blue. This is totally unexpected. How could this kind of attack happen to a country like the United States that is a selfless force of good in the world? So the 9/11 exceptionalism narrative is maybe that extension of that this has to be something unprecedented, that this has to be something unheard of in the history of the world. So, and then you stress that there are lots of catastrophic consequences because of this, that if you see things through this narrative, right, this leads to 20 years of far-reaching consequences. So what are some of the after effects, the results of this particular narrative?
You're absolutely right that the narrative prevents us from seeing many things. And one of the primary things that the events of 9/11 revealed is the vulnerability of the nation. And that vulnerability, it's disruptive of the 9/11 exceptionalist narrative. It's very, very hard to reconcile with it. And that is, of course, why the United States responded to 9/11 in a bellicose and overdetermined way, in order to cover up or to shield ourselves in many ways from the vulnerability that horrific day revealed. But it's also, you're right, the narrative of something that happened out of the blue, right? We are innocent nation. The United States, the idea of the United States as an innocent nation has been reasserted numerous times, especially in the 20th century. So things are visited upon us, but because we are so good, we can be nothing but innocent, right? So that erases, of course, you know, the colonial history of the United States, and it erases more than anything else the role of the U.S. as an empire, right? So lots of empires declare themselves, right? But the United States, the American empire, is one that is constantly narrated in many ways as something else. And that is in part because we see ourselves not as a nation that goes out and sort of exudes its will on others who don't want it, right? Or a nation whose foreign policy might produce the kind of rage that produced the terrorism on September 11th, right? And so Daniel Imarwara has this fantastic book called How to Hide an Empire, which is about how even though we have 800 military bases around the world and the same kind of military bases that enraged Osama bin Laden because they were in the Holy Land of Saudi Arabia, right? We think of ourselves not as an empire. And I think the idea of an empire is not very palatable to the American public, precisely because we're invested in our narrative as exceptional and as innocent, right? So what does that mean? One of the themes of the book is that we think of terrorism in the United States as something that is visited upon us from elsewhere, right? So foreign terrorism that comes out of the blue, right, that we apparently did nothing to provoke in the narrative, right? And part of what I want to argue is that the memorialization that has happened in this first quarter of the 21st century, that it begins in a very nationalistic 9/11 mode, right? Very pro-nation, very much about us being attacked by these foreign entities and all of the ways in which we have reasserted our power in its wake, right? And by the time we get to 2020 and we get toward the end of this era and the concerns and desires of people are shifting, right? And it's shifting more domestically away from this idea of the foreign terror, right? Memory projects begin to change. And that's why I end the book with the project of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, that is very deliberately saying that the United States has a very long history of racial terrorism, and they want to use that word terrorism to talk about terrorism in the United States and its relationship to the legacies of slavery and social injustice, et cetera. Right? So part of what I want to argue is that there is a kind of arc that takes place in this time period where we end up thinking about memory and memorialization, which is always highly political when we're talking about historical events, that begins to change from being a kind of nationalistic project to a project that really demands of us that we think about the complicity of the United States in much of this violent history.
So you start off with this kind of simplistic story a way of self-understanding that relies on erasing a lot, whether it's that American empire out there, and that makes it really difficult to understand that maybe 9/11, a big part of that was a reaction to American imperialism, these bases that are located all over the world, in particular in places like Saudi Arabia, next to important religious sites. So it's hard to grasp all that. And you see the world in maybe this Manichaean black and white way, good versus evil. And then there's a gradual evolution away from that simplistic view once you push into the later years of the wars on terror, that eventually that narrative starts to break down. But much of your book is on the simplistic part of it. And you mentioned how a whole range of things are overdetermined by this particular lens. And you talk about the construction of the 9/11 memorial as one prominent example in New York City. And throughout your book, you make these repeated references that there were other opportunities to make this a more inclusive project, to really serve the needs of the people. And you end up with these enormous monstrosities that real people that live in New York aren't actually using, that they don't provide a whole lot of space for critical reflection. And it's this idea that this narrative of 9/11 exceptionalism just kind of predetermines what's going to happen with this space. So if this is an event that you have to understand as unprecedented, as historic, a magnitude unknown in the history of humankind, how does this shape the possibilities for memorializing that space that end up doing, again, a memory disservice to the people?
New York City is really the sort of primary site at which this kind of excessive surfeit of memorialization in the United States post 9/11 took place. And in many ways, it is a pretty tragic and frustrating story about how to memorialize and how to rebuild a city, a very dense city, in relationship to this kind of violence. And I think that there are quite a number of different factors that feed into it. First, I think it's important that we acknowledge that there was an extraordinary amount of grief that emerged, and a sense of loss that was very, very profound. And just incredible stories of how people came together and helped each other survive and worked on the recovery operation, right? So this sort of powerful sense of emotion and just a powerful sense of loss, right? And so one of the things that happened, I mean, people were talking about memorialization in New York City on September 12th, right? Probably some of that is also about saying, well, this event is over, right? Which no one knew, of course, at that time, if it was. But part of what happened was then the political apparatuses, economic apparatuses began to unfold very, very early on. And so very early on, certain things got locked into place that if there had been even just a couple of years, 10 years might have been good. I think what was built downtown would have been significantly different. And it's funny, it's not that long ago, but it's hard for us to remember all of these things that happened so rapidly. Massive amounts of federal dollars were sent to a place like New York. There was an extraordinarily expensive project in the, you know, tens of millions of dollars to try and identify those, the remnants of those, the remains of those who had been killed. Very early on, politicians were claiming certain aspects of the site to be sacred, right? So Governor Pataki decided that the footprints of the towers would be sacred places that could never be built on. Now, that's an idea that maybe 5 years later might have looked a little bit absurd, but in, you know, I think it was October or November 2001, everyone just glommed onto that because they were, there was such powerful emotions happening. And so lots of things that got put into place that that meant that what we've ended up with 20 years later is an extraordinarily expensive project that resulted in an oversized memorial with a plaza that's very inhospitable, an enormous museum that a lot of historians are still, you know, debating the story that it tells, and a spectacular shopping mall that masquerades as a transportation center, and then a number of pretty bland office buildings. To the tune of just billions of dollars, much of it federal funding, right? And you're right, there were many, many alternative visions. In fact, in the first few years, even as the official process was underway, a lot of designers and architects were suggesting other ways to reimagine the space, and in particular, to reimagine the space as a public space that would include a site of mourning. So one of my primary critiques of the Michael Arad design of the memorial, and in many ways he was hemmed in by a lot of the meanings already laid in at the site, right? Is that it turns those two footprints of the Twin Towers, which after all, let's just remember, they were footprints of two office buildings, right, into pools, right? So enormous pools with water cascading down them. So they really take over the site, and the site becomes, the whole plaza area becomes kind of a place to stand to look into the pools. But it also means that those two enormous footprints, which are the size of a city block, they are sucked out of the plaza, right? And so design-wise, that makes very little sense, right? It also means we have two pools, right? Which if you were starting from scratch in a design where somebody hadn't designated these footprints to be sacred, you would never have two pools. It just would make no sense. People did these studies, the architects, where they found that people spend 15 minutes at the first pool and 5 at the second, depending on, you know, where they enter the plaza. Because the experience, except if you are going to search for particular names, the experience of the two pools is the same, right? So design-wise, there are a lot of missed opportunities here. And I should note that the designer, Michael Arad, had asked for a space underneath, a more intimate space underneath the pools where people would go and the names would be there and they could have a kind of intimate experience, which is the goal of many memorials, to honor those who had died. But designers were not the only people involved in what was built there. The security teams, because of the fear that this site will always be a target, had enormous influence on what was built, and they vetoed the idea of having underground chambers, and then also said, well, you'd have to have a security station on the way in. People would have to go through airport security style just to get to that contemplative moment, right? Same with the One World Trade Center tower that was built to replace the Twin Towers, right? Which is a big, banal, clunky building that's the result of a lot of architectural bickering. And there too, the security professionals had extraordinary power. There's no storefronts. There's no street life around it. It's surrounded by security bollards. The first 200 feet of it is just one big concrete clump, you know, bunker. And so there, the architects lost control in many aspects of that design. I recently took a group of students there, and when we're standing there now in 2024, it's hard to believe that anybody would have any interest in turning One World Trade Center into a Target, right? But that's not the way the world looked from the perspective of, 2004 or 5 when that plan was set into place, right?
So that's a big theme, right? That this security imperative, if there's any possibility that these are going to be places where people can congregate, have thoughtful exchanges, that security imperatives kind of crush the life out of them and they separate them off from the city. And in the case of the 9/11 memorial, you mentioned there's just a whole list of, it's not just the bollards. It's also all the things that you can't do, that you aren't allowed to do in those spaces.
Yes. And there too, the space is in many ways a private rather than a public space. The 9/11 complex is run by a private foundation. And it is also a space that has visible security and, invisible security, right? So the sense that it is not a public park is very strong. I mean, New York City public parks have a lot of activity in them. They have food trucks around the edges. They have, people protest in parks. None of that would be allowed at the memorial. Some of that is also because it is a memorial space, and there is a sense that there are certain kinds of activities that are not morally possible in a memorial space. And it's very interesting. There's a big debate about this at the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin, which in many ways shares a kind of aesthetic with it. It has lots of these stone stelae, and you can walk through them, and then on the edges they're lower, and sometimes people sit there and they do things like they picnic. And there was a big debate about, well, what kind of activities is it okay to have at a memorial? And the architect, Peter Eisenman, said, I want people to treat this like a public space. I want it to be about life. And so that is a debate that most memorials produce, right? How can we make this a space that honors the dead, but that is also a public space that is about life, honoring the activities of life and embracing life?
Yeah. And if there's one theme that's run through past episodes, for any kind of memory project to stand the test of time, it has to be connected to the community in some kind of meaningful way. So, and it seems like many of these projects you discuss are just end up being divorced from the general public. And you mentioned, well, you have these two pools that people spend 2 minutes on one pool, more time on the other, and then you put the museum in between the two, and people end up kind of the memorial becomes a sideshow for the museum. People spend even less time. The center of gravity tends to be the museum, which wasn't even the original project for the site. But if you look at the 9/11 memorial and museum, you mentioned that the museum is kind of caught up in this tension between having to memorialize the lives lost and tell the story of 9/11. And this ends up being an impossible mission, especially if you're trying to maintain this narrative of 9/11 exceptionalism. So you stress, well, it does a good job of commemorating, but not a great job of telling that story.
Yeah, I would say the museum's primary narrative and the narrative that shaped its building is a narrative of 9/11 exceptionalism. And it has two goals, and those two goals are in conflict, right? So one goal is to memorialize the almost 3,000 people who lost their lives that day, who were caught up in history that day. And the museum does a lot of that very effectively. It's actually extremely effective in telling the story of the day in New York City. It's dramatic. It's very powerful. It's very moving. And it uses a whole array of media to do that, and in particular, very effectively uses audio to do that and to bring the many of those who died, to bring them sort of present. But that also means that it was kind of caught up in a discourse of memorialization that did not allow it to really engage from an historical perspective with the meanings of 9/11. And the bottom line is that 9/11 was not one day. 9/11 was an event that continued on into the post 9/11 years. And we can't look at 9/11 without looking at the wars that the US pursued in its aftermath, in revenge, and the horrific destruction that we engaged with as a nation in response to this attack upon us. Now, as we came to a kind of end of the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, even though they remain in many ways kind of unresolved, there's much more willingness in the public, and some of this comes from veterans of those wars, to talk about all of the mistakes made in how those wars were pursued, right? And to talk about the tremendous loss that took place, not only the Americans who died, but the hundreds of thousands of Afghanis and Iraqis who died, and a much more larger destabilization of the region that certainly we are living with today. So the museum tells this story as uniquely about the attack upon the U.S., right? And fails in many ways to adequately address why it happened politically. It tries, but you know, a whole range of religious leaders have asked it from the very, very beginning to fix the part of the exhibit in which it seems to equate Islamic terrorists with all Muslims. And then it can't engage with the question of whether or not those wars made sense in terms of what happened in the United States. In a certain sense, that's because that discourse is in conflict with the discourse that is about mourning those who died. And
especially the innocent people. Right? The
innocent people who died,
who were just going to work and out of the blue, this horrendous disaster took place.
Yes, and innocent people whose life stories have often then been turned into justifications for these wars. And there are plenty of family members who have protested the way in which those narratives have happened, right? There again, there were opportunities early on to do something different. There were many people involved, including a number of historians who said we should build an international freedom center. We should use this as an opportunity to talk about freedom in relationship to this kind of terrorism, in relationship to violence, and do it more broadly to situate 9/11 in a broader context. And that got shut down pretty fast, mostly by politicians who said, no, everything we do on that site has to be only about September 11th. Again, in that moment, the fervor, the grief fed into that. Even 10 years later, I think that would have looked very different.
But if you turn to the rebuilding, so this is a 16-acre site, and you mentioned that there are these towers that go up particularly the One World Trade Center, and you spend a lot of time talking about that together with a shopping complex that's part of a hub transit point, the shopping complex called the Oculus. And you stress that 9/11 exceptionalism goes a long way towards generating money. funds for these particular projects. It goes into the design of these projects. But if 9/11 exceptionalism is something that has to leave out a lot to work, it tends to cover up a lot. It tends to mask a lot at the same time. And you stress that there are all kinds of economic interests and power brokers at work here that just seem to exploit the situation to the fullest. And they seem like they use this 9/11 exceptionalism to funnel crazy amounts of money into these projects. And they put up these symbols, but again, they're projects that don't seem to do a whole lot, especially for New Yorkers, for the general public, maybe for tourists. They're projects that really mask the interests behind them. And a lot of those interests just have to do with the stress, the nature of the real estate universe in New York City, and the big architect firms and the big developers, and they're cashing in on this whole period. And they're kind of raising the flag at the same time to hide a lot of what's going on. So how does that work? How does 9/11 exceptionalism funnel these enormous amounts of money and mask a lot of what is really happening behind the scenes?
Well, New York City, more than most cities, is a city that's really run by real estate developers. They have a really outsized amount of power. And it is one of the tragedies of 9/11 that 6 weeks before the buildings came down, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which had built them in the early 1970s, and we should always keep in mind that the mission of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey is to run the port and the airports and the systems of transportation around the city. It is not real estate, and they should never have built those buildings to begin with. So that was the first folly, right? But the Port Authority leased the Twin Towers to Larry Silverstein, a real estate developer. And that meant that once they came down, he and his insurance companies had an extraordinary amount of power to determine what would be built. The city, ironically, tragically, I guess, though, you know, the city has its own problems, had very little power over the site. So we've got the Port Authority, we have these real estate developers, and we have the governor of New York, right, who, of course, has power over the Port Authority, right? So the ownership of it was strange and convoluted, right? And one of the other sort of tragedies of what was finally built at great expense, right, is that it was already clear in 2001 that New York City's office space was overbuilt, right? And what does the city need? It needs housing, desperately needs housing, middle-class housing, affordable housing, right? It has a housing crisis that's just getting worse and worse, right? But the city didn't have the capacity to demand that, and Larry Silverstein wanted to rebuild office buildings. So that this one person had this enormous power is really truly a failure of governance. So now, by the time a lot of those buildings were built, and there are a few more that were sort of planned for that will probably never be built, right? We've gone into a pandemic. The way in which people work has changed. Companies have reduced their office footprints dramatically. New York City is filled with empty office buildings, right? So the tragedy looks even more ironic now, right? And so one of the things that I look at in this, and I have to say, when I was writing that chapter, my sort of sense of outrage just kind of kept growing and growing, right? It's also about how a certain facet of the architectural profession is really in cahoots with the ways in which real estate development in a city like New York is restructuring the city in a way that has absolutely no reference to the broader public, right? So now the New York City skyline has been dramatically changed by the building of the super high-end, very skinny condominium towers that are for the uber rich. Yeah, and many of them are uber rich people who are just parking illicit funds from other countries into real estate, right? Money laundering, effectively, right? And they don't just want to live in a fancy penthouse that looks over Central Park in a skinny, tall building. They want to live in one that is designed by a name brand architect, right? And so many of those architects, including Santiago Calatrava, who built the Oculus Transportation Center, and including Skidmore Owens Merrill Soame, that did the One World Trade Center, many of those architects were deeply involved in this rebuilding downtown. And there was a kind of strange way in which some of the initial highly patriotic design elements, some of which were suggested by Daniel Libeskind, who did the master plan, that came out of that moment of grief, right, somehow ended up surviving many years of designing and redesigning. And the one that probably shows us the absurdity the most is that One World Trade Center is 1776 feet tall, and it reaches that in part through a kind of clunky antenna that's on top, right?
Don't you mean a spire?
Yeah, a spire, I guess. Yeah, it looks like an antenna.
I thought that was hilarious. It had to be categorized not as an antenna if you wanted to get that record. It had to be described as a spire.
Yes. And, well, first of all, like, these contests about the tallest building, we could have a whole other discussion about the absurdity of that, right? And you can't tell that the building is that height just by looking at it. It's kind of an empty gesture. So this sort of sense that buildings should be narrative, buildings should tell stories, right? Santiago Calatrava says that the Oculus is about dove hope and doves flying up into the air, right? It is very spectacular, but it's a spectacular structure over a bunch of high-end stores, right? And so there's a whole sort of arena of high-end architects doing projects like this that aspire to be civic in some way, but really fail in that mission. So we could say the only public space in the Ground Zero complex is this Oculus space, which is a space where you're supposed to go shopping, which, of course, many people say is what makes it uniquely American.
So if this 9/11 exceptionalism lens has a powerful bearing over the rebuilding of the Ground Zero, what goes into the museum, what goes into the tower, and it helps to this good versus evil particular perspective and all that you have to mask and forget to make that work, if that helps justify 20 years of war on terror, it seems like the weight of those wars eventually starts to cause that particular lens to start to shatter. there's just too much. There's too much weight there. There's too much loss of life. There's too much of an expense. There's too many people coming home damaged for this narrative to keep on working. And that seems to be the theme, that you have a chapter on how the memory work connected to the wars on terror eventually is kind of causing a shift away from this 9/11 exceptionalism narrative. And a lot of that work has to do with just making visible all that you had to try to forget, mask, hide. And as you mentioned, a whole range of different artists, people who are doing portraits, people who are doing photography work, staging different kinds of temporary exhibits who are trying to put that reality on display. So how do artists make the reality that doesn't conform to this 9/11 exceptionalism narrative visible? What kind of work are they doing?
Yeah, this part of the project shifts a little bit toward work that is probably less known. And I think that the question of how to memorialize the post 9/11 wars remains a very unresolved one. I mean, there is an official project that has been approved in Washington to have a memorial to the victims of the global war on terror, I think it's phrased, but I actually don't think that's going to get built anytime soon. And so a lot of the work that was done, especially in the early years of the war, but also toward the years in which they were winding down, has been about responding to the fact that in many ways the wars were invisible to the broader American public. I mean, it's interesting, just recently in the election, the sort of attempt to try and make political points by talking about how the war in Afghanistan ended and how the, you know, Biden and the Democrats should be responsible for that. And it just didn't really work, right? Because of the sort of sense of those wars as not as relevant to what's going on in our nation right now. And I was very struck by some really powerful work that was about, you know, the very, very young Americans who died, especially in the early years of the war, you know, 18, 19 years old. And there's one particular project by Ashley Gilbertson, who's a very well-known photojournalist, who had been photographing in Fallujah and had had some traumatic experiences, where he went to the bedrooms of families throughout the country, many of them in the Midwest, where they had lost their son and daughter in the war, and they left their bedrooms untouched. And he, you know, collaborated with the families, and you're just so struck at how young these bedrooms look. But then also, I think what's very powerful about those images is that you see how unresolved it is. It's actually not a really healing thing to have a bedroom shrine to someone who's been killed, right? It's not a way of finding something reparative out of loss. In many ways, it's a kind of metaphor for us as a nation. I'm very struck now that we really have a lot of very visible veterans of those wars as public figures, many of them serving in Congress across the political spectrum, right? And the sort of sense of those veterans having a certain kind of moral power to speak to issues of power and the U.S. and our engagements on foreign territories. So I think we're still learning about and wrestling with the aftermath of those wars. But in a certain sense, I do think that invisibility remains the same. I mean, these were wars that were fought largely by National Guardsmen. I mean, there was not a draft. Most Americans were not directly affected by them. And there was a very deliberate attempt by the U.S. government to avoid narratives of sacrifice, you know, so the censoring of the images of the return of coffins, right, the sort of sense especially in the Bush administration, that we were not going to allow Americans to fully register the sacrifice of America that was being demanded of certain Americans in those wars of revenge.
Okay. So if this period of 9/11 exceptionalism begins, you can begin it with the example of the 9/11 Memorial and Museum, and you kind of end the period with a new, which you commented on the beginning, a new memorial in Montgomery, Alabama, to the memory of lynching, and this legacy museum that's connected to that. You use that as an example of how we're moving into a very different kind of memory era. So how different is the memory work of the this National Memorial for Peace and Justice and the Legacy Museum compared with what was going on in the 9/11 Memorial and Museum?
It would be very interesting to see over the next decade or so whether or not this kind of memory activism continues to grow, right? And one of the things that's most interesting about the Equal Justice Initiative project, which is run by Brian Stevenson, is that together they decided that the best way to intervene in the issues of social and racial justice, and in particular in relationship to the criminal justice system and to the mass incarceration of African Americans in the United States, that the best way to intervene in that, even though they are lawyers, they go to the courts every day, right, was to do a memory project, right? So they saw that as a kind of cultural form that would allow them to educate beyond the courtroom, maybe even potentially to educate future jurors in the state of Alabama. And so I was very struck by the fact that the impetus for this memorial and museum was a very particular, very explicit agenda about how we have to reframe how we understand the history of racial terror in the United States. And the way to do that, in this case, they started with the question of lynching and how lynching constituted a form of terrorism. People were lynched. They were put on display. The whole point of it was to terrorize the broader population of African Americans in the South, right? And of course, that was very effective. It ended up being a key factor in the great migration of Blacks in the late 19th and first half of the 20th century out of the South to the North and the Midwest. And so they created a memorial, the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, and a museum, the Legacy Museum, that are really attempting to kind of re-script American history. And to one of my colleagues, Allison Landsberg, says, you know, the Legacy Museum, it's not really a history museum, it's a memory museum, because it's making an argument with memory, right? And almost like a legal argument that you might make in a courtroom, right? And it's saying slavery didn't end. This is what Brian Stevenson says. Slavery didn't end. It evolved, right? And it evolved into these other practices that really start, you know, post-Civil War, right? So it evolved into lynching, it evolved into laws about segregation, right? And now it has evolved into mass incarceration. And so if we can see those legacies and histories, then what we really need to do is to find ways to reform the criminal justice system and to demand that this situation of mass incarceration be reformed, right? But design-wise, the memorial does something that's very effective, right? Which is, it has these stone pillars that are hanging down, columns, right? And it has the names of those who were lynched in particular counties engraved on them. And as you walk through it, you are kind of brought into the position of looking up at the stones, right? So on one hand, they're kind of threatening, right? On the other hand, you're reminded that they look like bodies, even though they're abstract, right? And then that kind of puts you in the position of the person who looked up at the lynched body hanging down, right? It's very subtle, right? But you can't really go through that memorial without feeling, especially if you're a white person, without feeling implicated in that history in some way. And I think the design, which they did with Mass Projects, a design firm, is very effective at producing that, right? The Legacy Museum does another version of that, but it's really demanding of people who come to visit that they think about this history and that they really think about the nation and then think in positive ways about how to help the nation sort of address its histories and to move forward. Bryan Stevenson is very articulate, you know, and he says, I want this not to make us feel despair, but to liberate us. We have to address this history in order to be liberated. So the whole project is really about demanding more from national narratives, right? And in that sense, it's really the polar opposite of the story of 9/11 exceptionalism.
Marita, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Marita Sturkin is a professor in the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication at New York University. I've been talking with her today about her book, Terrorism in American Memory, Memorials, Museums, and Architecture in the Post-9/11 Era. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. The best endorsement is word of mouth. I'm Rick Dedarian. See you soon.